Untold. We're back with another episode, and I'm super excited to introduce you to Mr. Al Overton. Al, how are you doing?
I'm great, thanks.
Fantastic.
Thanks for having me. What an honour.
No. Thank you for coming in. I think it's fantastic to have you in and sort of get to this point. I remember probably 4 or 5 years ago chasing you down when you were at Planet Organic and handing you a savoury snack bar that wasn't even in...
So wasn't it a pre-production sample at that point?
Yeah, it was. And then I think it got to a point where I was looking through our previous emails, and I think it got to a point where you replied to an email and changed the headline saying, I get the impression I'm being followed, because I think I'd stalked you at a couple of trade shows. So it's great that we've got to this point and can have a little chat. I'd love to kick off, just give the listeners a bit of colour to you and your background. If you can kind of, in a short, snappy way, just explain your career so far and sort of what you brought you up to now, and then we'll sort of come on to what's next.
Short and snappy. I'm not good at short and snappy. I'll try and make it brief. So I guess I've been at Planet Organic for a long time. It's sort of the headline. I originally got into this field, I suppose, by training as and qualifying as a medical herbalist. Sort of with an ambition that I was going to run a private practice and heal the sick. And it turned out that was an expensive hobby rather than a job. And it also turned out that I didn't really like sick people that much. So sort of got into retail as an alternative. So worked for Neil's Yard Remedies for quite a long time, which at the time was very much sort of walk-in, I suppose, alternative first aid gig, which was awesome. And then joined Planet in 2001 when they had two stores, working as health and body care manager for the one that was in the West End. And then sort of stayed and did a little bit of everything. So when I joined, it was very much a small company, which meant you ended up doing everything. So the buyer at the time didn't really know anything about skincare or supplements. So I started advising on ranging, got into buying, ran training programs, looked after e-commerce for a while, looked after most things for a while. And for the last 12 years, really been sort of recruiting, building the buying team and running the buying function at Planet.
Amazing, fantastic. And did you, I mean, that is obviously, I mean, it's a hell of a long time to be at Planet. You must have seen the brand just explode from when you first joined to where it is, the brand is today.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as I said, joined when we had two stores, left when we had 14. But I think much more than that, joined when Planet had a relatively narrow focus as being an organic supermarket.
Yeah.
And the vision was to slowly become more and more and more organic and to be just an organic supermarket.
So
very much on the model of a Biocoop or Laviclair in France.
Yeah.
And then I think over time, sense of self and concept changed, became much more about inspiration and experience, much more about sort of speciality free from foods, and then really sort of built this reputation as, hopefully built this reputation as sort of real innovators within the space.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, that mission of really trying to inspire customers to eat better.
Yeah.
Because fundamentally it's all about health at the end of the day, but how do you make that cool and interesting and engaging? Rather than being the same tired old, eat lots of fresh vegetables, eat a broad variety of whole grains.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. So same old message. I think that what really sticks out to me there is the kind of experience around from the shopper. And I think when you go into a Planet, people can now go and have lunch and sit down, and it really does become that kind of, actually, rather than just nipping in to buy some broad beans, you're going in to sort of have a browse and then maybe have some lunch and kind of that whole experience. And I think it's fascinating. We had Rene, who founded Planet Organic, on the podcast in the very early days. I think she was maybe within the first five episodes that we put out. So it's really interesting to kind of see it from that perspective and now see it evolve kind of where it has done. And so you started building out a team. Did you enjoy that side of it, the kind of management side? Obviously, there's a huge difference between the buying side and the managing a big team. Is there kind of an intrinsic side of you inside you that goes, oh, yeah, this is really exciting?
I don't think I'm a natural manager. I mean, you'd have to talk to my team about that. I think if you've got an amazing team, then working with the team is amazing.
Yeah.
And I was either lucky or a very good recruiter, and managed to build, you know, a team of, you know, very skilled, very enthusiastic people who I think have really helped sort of push that Planet mission.
Yeah.
If I'm honest, I prefer doing things
yeah.
to managing yeah, yeah, yeah. someone else no, I hear you. To I do hear them.
For the listeners, I'd love to kind of get into the sort of challenger brand landscape that Planet Organic became and, well, still are a platform for challenger brands, or there's an element of Planet Organic that is a, yeah. is a platform rather than the whole brand itself. I think it would be great to kind of hear your thoughts on the challenger landscape at the moment, obviously with the current climate that's going on, but also kind of what trends you've seen. And this is kind of like four or five questions wrapped into one. It's a proper Harry waffle, but I guess kind of key bits of advice that you could give challengers in the current climate, but also the evolution that you've seen over those past kind of 12 years building out your team, how the health food brand world or the health food world has kind of evolved and changed, if that makes sense.
I think that's about 12 questions.
Yeah, sorry.
Question, if I'm honest. So I think Planet became, sort of consciously became a platform and a launch pad for either startup brands in the UK or international brands entering the UK for the first time. Because of that real mission around inspiration and experience. And we assume that actually a lot of the time our customers don't particularly come with a shopping list. They might need this, that, or the other, but they also just come for the experience and come to walk around and to see what's new. And newness and innovation was one of the things that essentially brought them in through the door.
Yeah.
So we chased that quite hard. We were able to be fairly nimble in terms of range reviews, putting product on shelf, and the speed with which we could launch new ranges.
Yeah.
Rather than that, oh well, I'm reviewing the jam category in October, so talk to me then.
Yeah.
So you know, when I was there, there's probably what 5,000 products on the shelves of Planet Organic, and we'd list about 2,000 new products every year.
Wow.
The dark side of which is that we discontinued 2,000 products every year.
Yeah,
so that's
yeah,
the
course.
Bits that no one
yeah.
likes to talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's just sort of constant innovation. Because I do think it is about inspiration and excitement. And we didn't always get it right in the same way that, you know, brands don't always get it right. But I think it also came about because Free From started to sort of seriously happen. And became exciting. And there were brands that started as, you know, raw food brands or gluten-free brands. And they sort of turned those categories from being around almost sort of special needs foods into, you know, tasty and delicious and exciting foods.
Yeah.
So probably the first sort of real innovation was around raw food when that happened. So, you know, you go back in the day and you've got Living Food Kitchen, you've got the foundations of Onbar and the raw chocolates and all that sort of stuff. And that was the first time that we really went, this could be significant in terms of making space for sort of new and emerging categories.
Yeah.
So then you start searching further afield and, you know, the team come back from Expo West last 1 year and go, well, it's all about fermented drinks and sauerkraut. And I'm like,
yeah.
Right, okay, fair enough. So then you clear a bay and you list every single kombucha brand you can find. And you sort of turn around and look at it now and go, well, that was a definite success.
Yeah.
I do think there has always been conflict and challenge within the health food space from a what should we eat point of view.
Yeah.
And I think one of the fundamental challenges of the food industry in this country is that we've lost our traditional food culture for whatever reason, and none of us have got a bloody clue what we're supposed to be eating.
Yeah.
And what we have seen over time is I think those messages are starting to align. So rather than low fat versus high fat or protein's good, protein's bad, don't eat eggs, I'll definitely eat eggs, you know, we've finally sort of settled on, right, sugar. Let's pay attention to sugar.
Yeah.
In the same way that, you know, the sort of the sustainability message has become a little bit clearer when you can go, right, let's focus on the plastic.
Yeah.
Because I can't see the carbon dioxide.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But there's still that you know, there's still that battle raging, isn't there? Mm. You know, it's raging within the plant-based space a lot.
Yeah.
So we'll still see how the market evolves, develops, and grows.
Yeah.
That's the exciting part. As long as we are inspiring customers and citizens to eat well and live better,
yeah,
then happy days. That's what it's all about.
I think that's great. And I think it's a really key point when you break stuff down to pick a headline issue. And I think you see in a lot of challenger brands, we've fallen foul of it in the past, where you start going, let's be everything to everybody, and let's be high protein, high fiber, low calorie, low sugar. And actually, before you know it, the call-outs take up half of the space, and
yeah,
people don't know what the product is, but they know.
And you're trying to talk to a subset of a subset of a subset of a subset of people, so you end up with one target customer.
You
need broad appeal. Really.
Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, you're not talking to enough people, and you also need to be broad so that you can inspire change in the people that haven't changed yet.
Yeah.
And if you're only talking to the converted,
yeah,
you've got a limited market and a limited opportunity.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think, yeah, I completely agree, and it's about sort of, as the food industry, putting our arms around everybody and going, actually, you can do this. And it will still taste really nice. I think that's the other thing, is you kind of go, a lot of brands go too far. And I mean, we had it with our first iterations of bars, where you're like, it tasted a little bit cardboardy. And it's because we'd gone, we want to hit high protein, high fiber, And you give it to a recipe developer or a manufacturer, and they kind of fall off their chair because they're like, this is almost impossible to produce.
Yeah. I think there's always a challenge to turn around and go, this product isn't viable. And I think brands find that really tough.
Yeah.
And it might not be viable because of price.
Yeah.
So we've got this amazing recipe. We need to sell it for 10 quid.
Yeah.
Well, the market can only stand 5 quid. Yeah. It's not a viable product at that stage.
Yeah.
We're going to use this special ingredient and that special ingredient, and we're not going to do this and we're not going to do that. I used to see it in the good old days. I saw it a lot in skincare brands, actually. Yeah. And they go, well, we're not going to put in this whole long list of ingredients. In which case, the end result is sort of a byproduct of what you haven't done, and you've ended up with something that doesn't smell particularly nice, isn't very nice to use, and you're appealing to that real hardcore dark green consumer who goes, well, I don't need it to smell very nice because I'm saving the planet. Products need to be either delicious or attractive, or they need to be great products, otherwise people aren't going to buy into them and keep buying them.
Absolutely, I completely agree. And I think it's also like very specific to category as well. So when you get to health claims, like for snacking, for example, consumers will be happy to find protein through snacking. But actually, if they're serious enough that you're targeting someone with a fibre claim on the front of pack, they're probably going to get their fibre from their yogurt or different parts of the day, because it's already ingrained into them that they should be having more fibre, and therefore actually finding an impulse snack that has high fibre is not going to be actually resonate with the people who you're trying to resonate with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I think it's those sort of like nutritional ingredient claim or health claim is often about trying to persuade the customer that there's the same benefit to the thing that they were going to buy that you're trying to persuade them to buy. So you see a lot of the sort of the plant-based meat alternatives now saying high in protein, because they want the customer to know that just like the meat that you were going to eat, it's got a lot of protein in it. I do think, as consumers, we really don't understand most on-pack health claims. I went to a talk ages ago, and the customer research had showed that people were buying stone-baked pizza because they thought it was healthier. And, the single probably most effective health claim there's ever been on a product is made with real fruit.
Yeah.
Which isn't even a health claim, but everyone reads that and goes, it must be good for you then. And that's sort of going back to the days of Robinson's barley water, isn't it?
Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it? It is mental, and I think we all get, certainly in the challenger landscape, I say we, not every brand does, but a lot of brands get wrapped up in that. And I think the what health is viewed in the trade versus what health is viewed as a consumer are two completely different things in terms of product development.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've always paid a lot more attention to the occasion rather than the product. I suppose because I've listed a lot of weird products that don't fit into any pre-existing category. Like, you know, some idiot did these savoury snack bars. But, you know, you look at what is the consumer occasion for that product.
Yeah.
You know, when and why are they going to buy it? What else would they have normally bought?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think you then need to target your messaging around the occasion rather than trying to explain what the product is. Because if you, and you know, sometimes if you explain too much what a weird ass product is, the customer just goes, well, that's weird.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's such a fine line. And it's so interesting to hear your experience on it, because I think a lot of brands get so wrapped up in that kind of mind map of consumers. And Jenny is a city worker that has da da da, and she goes to the gym, and she goes here, and she goes, and I mean, we've done it at the Savourist, but I think it's always done with a rose tinted glasses. Whereas to your point, if you're looking at occasions and what they want from that occasion, it's a completely different exercise. Yeah.
And it's unusual for there to suddenly be a new occasion.
Yeah,
you know, it does happen. So, you know, breakfast on the go.
Yeah.
Sort of was created and started as an occasion because, you know, people used to eat breakfast at home.
Yeah.
You know, I've got ex-investors and colleagues at Planet who spent a long time at Marks & Spencer's, and they still tell stories about launching the first pre-packed sandwich.
Yeah.
And what a revolution that was, because who the hell needs a ready-made sandwich? So, yeah, you can create new occasions, but that's proper hard.
And I guess coffee was that as well, right? Like, back in the day, now you go, you can't walk 100 metres without a pot of coffee shop. Or like, but more the occasion of going in and sitting in like a Starbucks. And like it's to your point on Planet, creating an experience. Coffee has become an experience now where you can go in and I mean, I've never done it, but people do go in and sit in Starbucks. Well, unless it's for a meeting, but you go in and you sit down and you look around and you're kind of like, actually, I'm just going to sit here and just enjoy this cup of coffee.
Well,
and
you know what? I remember I was working in Neil's Yard Remedies in Bromley Shopping Centre in probably the late 90s, and it was this tiny little shop in the basement of a shopping centre with no natural light. In my lunch break, there was bugger all to do other than go and sit in the food court. Suddenly Starbucks opened.
Yeah.
And I was like,
dreaming.
It's got a comfy armchair.
Yeah,
I went for the comfy armchair.
Yeah.
What I ate and drank was sort of irrelevant. It's like, it's not a plastic seat.
It's so good. It's
and
so
sometimes good. You get, and some other bastard would be in the comfy armchair and you'd be like, shit. But, you know, it's the little things sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the most annoying little things is when they put a fucking code on the toilet.
Yes.
And you can only have it, it's on your receipt. Hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Untold Podcast is brought to you by The Savourist. We're here to keep you jiggling at snack time. We have a range of mega flavour, loaded ingredient, real nutritious snacks. They taste absolutely banging. And we have a brand new range of crunchets, which are made from black beans, edamame beans, puffed rice, seasoned with a Thai chilli and a sizzling barbecue. Yes, I promise you, they are as delicious as they sound. Thanks so much for your time. Enjoy the rest of the episode and check us out at savourist.com. Ta-da! Let's first talk about kind of what's next. And obviously, you've left Planet now.
I have left Planet now.
Talk to us about I don't want to do it in injustice. So talk to us about the project that you've now set up and the businesses.
So, I mean, I'm looking to do a number of things, I suppose, but the most significant is I've set up a strategy and growth consultancy called Wonderland Ventures. And it's sort of, it's a fairly broad approach, multidisciplinary consultancy. There's sort of three of us thrown our lot in together. So myself, my ex-CEO from Planet, Peter Marsh, who obviously he and I have worked together for a long time, and a guy called Lawrence Barnett, who currently runs a brand design agency.
Amazing.
And just looking to work with, you know, any brands within the health and well-being space who need help, really. And from my background and expertise, if I have one, I suppose that's around trend forecasting, market dynamics, looking at product range architecture, looking at retail strategies, looking at, you know, helping brands, how do you approach a buyer? I mean, you know, there's no sort of secret to it, but there's an art to it, probably. But then with a broader approach, potentially looking at branding and brand positioning, looking at business strategy. So, yeah, it's an exciting project.
Yeah.
You know, I'm also looking to work direct with some businesses and brands that I've sort of formed pretty strong relationships with over the years, and try and find that joyous balance of doing things that you want to do as well as things that you sort of have to do and pay the bills. You know, my personal passion is very much around the real sort of sustainability staples brands. So how do we get people as citizens to make better choices about the fundamental things that we eat a lot of? So rather than, you know, a snack isn't going to save the world.
It can
be about instigating change. How do you get someone to pay attention to the bread they eat, or where the rice is from, or that sort of thing? And that's the unsexy side of it, is hard to make sexy. But, you know, I'd really like to do more around that. But also, you know, I've launched a lot of new brands at Planet. I've seen what works, what doesn't, haven't always got it right. And I really enjoy it, you know. I love that. I love the startup space.
It's great.
I've always, you know, spoken to brands at every stage of their development. Some of whom come to you with an idea and samples they made in their kitchen. It's, you know, it's exciting.
It's amazing. I guess you have that kind of the bridge between two, right? Having a platform to do it, but also the other side is speaking to challenger brands. I think it's fantastic. And what a founding team there as well. I think the experience that you've got is brilliant. So putting that hat on, I guess if we start with kind of trends and stuff that you see coming around the corner, I mean, if we take away, I mean, obviously the current economic climate isn't amazing. And when I say isn't amazing, it's terrible. But so if we part that slightly, in terms of food evolution, if you were to take a macro, a category and go on macro, let's say plant-based, for example, where do you sort of see that evolving in kind of the next few years, or do you see it evolving?
Yeah, I mean, I think plant-based is going to be fascinating to watch and has been fascinating to watch so far. I think it will become multiple categories rather than one. So I think there will be, you know, if you look at what's happening within the sort of alternative meat space, you've got brands who are really focused on the, we don't care what's in it, we just want it to taste like meat. And then you've got brands really focused on, well, actually, we're only going to make it from, you know, chickpeas, hemp seeds and love. And it's to fulfill the bacon occasion rather than to taste like bacon. And, you know, from one point of view, you go, well, you know, what's the end result of that and who's going to win? I think the answer is they're both going to win. Because, you know, if you look at, let's take meat as a category, there are people that care where their meat is from. And there are people that don't. So if you were going to buy a pack of Richmond sausages, then you'll buy the Richmond meatless sausages and you won't scrutinise the ingredients list. But there is the customer who actually cares about sort of the ingredients and the provenance. So there's space for both. So I think there's going to be so much growth within that category. I think the challenge for smaller brands to date is that the startup costs within that, I mean, so far it's mostly been a tech business. Startup costs are bloody massive. And, you know, I had the frustration of talking to quite a number of international brands in the space when I was at Planet. It was like, hey, do you want to come and sell on our shelves? Because we've got these amazing, like at the time, 10 stores in London. And they were like, no, I need about 400 stores in the UK and then I need 500 in France because I want to open a second factory. So, you know, they're talking to the major players and that's it. Whereas the sort of the smaller brands, you know, we've seen a lot happen within plant-based cheese. But now I can buy Vegan Philadelphia and Primula have done a plant-based. I mean, when was the last time anyone bought Primula? But suddenly you look at Primula plant-based and you go,
Yeah, that's interesting.
So yeah, I think it is going to be multiple categories.
Yeah, I agree.
And we'll also get supermarket own brand.
Yeah,
starting to play in the space as well once it becomes big enough.
Yeah.
So it's almost too big to talk about in ways. I suppose the answer is, how are smaller brands going to navigate through that space? And then it's really about focus on the occasion and developing an awesome product that is viable.
Yeah.
I think we can safely assume that over time, meat consumption is going to go down and down.
100%, yeah.
What I don't know is, or what's unclear or what's quite weird at this stage, is that meat-free seems to be the thing that's happening. So I still put eggs in it, but it's a meat-free product. Yeah, so there's going to be confusion over labelling, I think.
Yeah,
I've seen a number of, particularly within food service, you know, a meat-free pizza.
Yeah.
You know, but it's still got cheese on it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a vegan pizza.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, what does the customer understand by plant-based?
Yeah.
When plant-based... When plant-based first came out sort of as a label, I think it was mostly used by people who didn't want to be 100% vegan but wanted to communicate that they were eating less meat.
Yeah.
So it was sort of less of an absolute label, because as soon as you tell someone you're vegan and then you go out and, you know, you buy a new pair of shoes and they go, oh, I thought you were vegan. It becomes a label that people beat you over the head with.
That's really
so nice. It was sort of an anti-label to start with.
Yeah.
So I'm not answering the question.
I'm
rabbiting off at tangents.
It's fascinating because what it sounds like is really that flexitarian or veganism has the potential to be rebranded as being what vegan stands for now. Has the potential to be rebranded, or at least split into segments.
I think fundamentally what's happening is that the decision over what should we eat is becoming even harder.
Yeah.
Because it's never been entirely clear what we should eat from a health point of view, because everyone you talk to has got a different opinion.
Yeah.
And then you throw in the sustainability angle and the packaging angle to that, and how do you balance local versus, you know... unpackaged versus plant-based versus all of that. So that sort of what the hell should I eat has just got even harder to answer.
Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it? Crazy. I think that whole piece is super interesting. Just taking back to occasions. And when we sort of link in how brands should approach buyers into that, so they've gone through the process, they've done their product development, or they're at the stage of kitchen samples. I think it's a lot easier for brands that have been around a few years. MPD comes along, they've got the contacts to then go out with factory samples, for example, or kitchen samples, rather than trying to sell in cold, not having that network. What would be your kind of biggest advice? Someone's at that stage of kitchen samples, products great, occasions there. How would you go about approaching buyers and a strategy for kind of go to market? Obviously, in a zipped up way. But...
So, I think firstly, be very targeted in terms of who you're approaching, and make sure that your product is actually a right fit in that retailer, because it's not a right fit in all. So. When I was a buyer at Planet, how many people did I have contacting me about olive oil? Bloody hundreds.
Yeah.
Am I interested in premium olive oil? No. Wasn't our business.
Yeah.
Didn't care. In the same way that if you're some uber speciality health foods, you know, a farm shop is probably not the right place to go.
Yeah.
So sort of positioning is key.
Yeah.
Having an awesome product.
Going to help.
And I think trying to get some real honest feedback on your product, because, you know, I've been pitched to hundreds of times. I've done, you know, all of those sort of speed dating things at new brand events, and there's some really terrible ideas out there, unfortunately. So, you know, get it second and third checked in terms of not just because your mother-in-law said it was a great idea.
Yeah.
And then after that, I mean, you know this better than me, but it's really about charming persistence, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's about going to the places that buyers are. It's about understanding what their strategy is, knowing that depending on which buyer you're talking to. So Planet was kind of unique because the buyers were always looking for new stuff. They had inboxes full of new stuff, and would reply to the ones that they wanted. Multiples aren't necessarily looking for new stuff by people they've never heard of.
No.
You know, 80% of their time is spent being really, 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 really nice to their key brands.
Yeah.
And in terms of what's their NPD strategy, well, I'll wait and see what my key brands come to me with.
Yeah.
So as a challenger brand, you're sort of a distraction and a diversion and a bit of a risk.
Yeah.
So getting out there, being charmingly persistent, sharing whatever successes you've got, but also understanding where your where your target retailers are competing with.
Yeah.
So you don't walk into Planet Organic and go, it's doing really well in Whole Foods.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be brilliant, happy days, but you know, how much are they how much are they interested in sort of uniqueness of range and being first to market and all the rest of it?
And it also kind of feels like you're almost like pinning them against, it feels like you're trying to back them into a corner by being like, well, your competitor's doing really well. Why the hell aren't you doing it? It's like that I mean, I've never understood brands that do that, because you're like, that surely that's just a sure way to just piss a bar off, because you're like
you're doing such a shit job.
Yeah exactly. It's kind of like, I think that the really interesting thing that we hear, or sales guys or as founders of brands hear from buyers all the time, is around the occasion, but providing data. And obviously Planet is different because, as you say, you're looking for that, but they go, but if the data is the Lego blocks, build a story out of data, right? Out of the Lego, build a house out of Lego. What I've always found really interesting is, like, we can spend a whole day building a presentation, 2-3 days building a presentation to send off that shows where you sit in a category. But you're kind of like, I mean, with bars it's different, but for the new Crunchets range, it's like, it's a bag of crisps that sit in savoury snacking that's made from black beans, edamame and puff rice. Like, the difference is obvious, but there's nothing, as you say, to your point, like, we're not building a rocket ship, we're not going to save the world.
Yeah.
Like, it's always, like, really like a push and pull. Like, it almost feels like they're trying to do it to just kind of get them off their back for a little bit, rather than, surely as a buyer, you already know, you'll see a product and you go, I know exactly where this can sit because I buy for this category.
Yes, and there's, you know, I think brands have all been told and think that they need to have this amazing story and that people care. No one really cares about the story.
Yeah.
The customer, the final customer that's going to pick something off the shelf, doesn't care about the story.
Yeah.
They might over time get to love the story.
Yeah.
And that will really deepen their relationship with the brand.
Yeah.
But also, you know, recognise that buyers are fairly superficial, shallow people.
Yeah.
And they know enough about their category to look at a product, look at the packaging, eat it and go yes or no.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some very simple basics, like if you're emailing a buyer and you're sending them an attachment, don't make it something they need to unzip, because they won't bloody unzip it. Like, really?
Yeah.
Don't make it more than 6 slides, because they won't get to the end.
Yeah.
Don't, like, give them all of the data about their category and what growth it's in, because they know all of that.
Yeah.
You know, start with a picture of your happy shining product, and then tell them how your happy shining product is going to increase their sales or their margin.
Yeah.
Because that's sort of what they want to know. But, you know, keep it really...
And what's a key sort of metric to that success? So if I put on there, look, we will bring in incremental sales because it isn't powdered ingredients that's making a puffed product, it's real ingredients. Like, that's obviously on a kind of... So not going into the detail too much, but what if someone's selling into your snacking category and they say, we want to increase your sales and this is how we're going to do it, what does good look like in terms of this is how we're going to do it? Is it a promotional plan, or is it more around who you're going to bring into the category?
So I think it looks like being within a sort of a subcategory or speciality that's in growth.
Yeah.
So are you a protein bar? Protein bars are growing, but actually we're a plant-based protein bar, and that's underrepresented in mainstream. So, you know, there's Grenade, but they don't do this. So we're a bit like Grenade, but we're doing better because of blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, you know, within sort of, you know, if you can say, well, we're a bit like your best brand, but we're better because, or we're targeting a slightly different customer because.
Yeah.
You know, you definitely need to establish point of difference.
Yeah.
Because if you go, we're another crisp.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, I've got a lot of crisps.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're staples, and they probably sell very well as well.
So. Yeah. So, and then after that, it is, you know, it also, it's very down to category because, you know, snacking is a fundamentally disloyal customer.
Yeah.
If you try and launch a new skincare brand, that's completely different in terms of, you know, how long it takes, number of ranges that get listed by a retailer, how long it takes to really bed in, get a customer.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, get to know, if you can, get to know beforehand how the retailer operates. In terms of range review dates, in terms of is there pay to play in terms of marketing, what sort of promotions do they run and can you support that and are you willing to support that, you know, some sort of launch plan so that it's actually going to, you know, fly off the shelves.
Yeah.
If they have demoing and sampling in their stores, telling them that you've got people that can do that, preferably good people.
Yeah.
Who don't stand there on their phone, you know, don't get your out-of-work brother-in-law to go in and sample your product. It just looks terrible. You know, yeah. It's a hard, bloody thing to do.
Agreed.
Do it well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sort of understand what follow-up they're going to need.
Yeah.
Because the slightly irritating thing from a retailer point of view is when you get dumped fairly early by the brand.
Yeah.
Because they sort of tick you off and go, right, we're done there.
Done, yeah.
Moving on.
Yeah.
Another absolute basic is make sure that you put the right company name in the email.
Yeah, oh my God, yeah.
I mean, it happens so often.
Yeah. I mean, I see it even from the other side of suppliers that we use, packaging suppliers or people that reach out on LinkedIn, and it's like, hi, John. And I'm like, ah?
Yeah.
Like, my name is literally in the little window at the bottom of your screen. Like, it's crazy, right? But, no, that's a key point, and I think... where would brands find promotional strategies and like let's say someone that isn't in the industry?
So talking to other brands that are already within that retailer, sort of the brand network spaces, I think there's more and more of them. I think they're incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
There are now quite a number of either events or sort of support networks out there for small brands.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to get into Planet, for example, you know, talk to someone that's done it. How did you do it?
Yeah.
Do you know the name of the buyer?
Yeah.
So actually find out who they are so you can send a targeted email.
Yeah.
Most companies, if you know the name that you're trying to talk to, you can make several guesses as to what their email address might
be.
Absolutely. So you're getting through direct rather than, you know, buying at.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you just try and sort of understand who it is that you're talking to and how they operate.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. And... difference between persistence and charm and persistence and pissing off, like what because it's so hard, and I mean
you
must know, because it's, you're kind of at that point where you're like, especially when you set up, and you've always had that, but stepping away from Planet and moving on now, I'm sure is a similar feeling when you go as a founder of a brand or as a sales member in a small brand, challenger brand, you're like, a week is a hell of a long time. But to a buyer, a week is nothing, right? So it's so hard to get that balance right. Like, I find myself now, we've been around four years, but with the launch of our new range, it's like, I'm like, Sainsbury's have come back to us in an email, and then I go back and it's like, oh my God, it's been 4 days. Why haven't they come back? And I know, like, my sensible head goes, oh, come on, Harry, grow up, man. You're, like, 32. Like, stop waiting for a buyer to get back to you. But in the office, I'm super excited. No. Why hasn't it come back to me?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so hard to judge. What do you think is the kind of ideal timeline of, to your point earlier when you said buyers look for all the emails, they get back to the ones that they like, and they don't to the ones that they're not going to list. But to what point do you kind of... make sure that you're back at the top of that inbox? What, like, I guess there's no rhyme or reason to it, but...
There isn't, but no, you're right. A week in the life of a buyer is not much.
No.
Because, you know, you go through your week where Monday you're reviewing sales, Tuesday you're doing all the things that you said you were going to do at the sales meeting, and Monday the point at which you get to go through your inbox and reply to all of the brands that you're not currently dealing with is like Friday afternoon.
Yeah. So
a week is not long.
Yeah.
I think, you know, chasing up a first email after a couple of weeks is fine.
Yeah.
I think sort of anything more than monthly after that becomes relatively stalkerish.
Yeah.
But it's also always nice to talk, to be able to talk about successes.
Yeah.
Just to let you know, we had, you know, great exposure when, you know, the founder did this radio interview with so-and-so last night. Or that sort of exposure.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this is our latest customer review from this online platform that we're selling on. Or,
great.
You know, something interesting. Doing it with... You're doing it with personality, but without trying to be weird about it. Because everyone thinks they need to stand out from the crowd, which means you get some real sort of wacky shit sent to you.
What's been the wackiest? Can you talk about it?
No.
Which category?
The things that... So I'll tell you what. Me personally, the things that used to annoy me most is when you get a box and it's like it's your birthday. And they put in like a branded wooden spoon and yet another bloody tote bag and some unrequested samples, and you know, someone sent me this like series of boxes. They were doing a tea brand for different occasions and they sent a different box. So the wake-up tea had like a little alarm clock. And this is beyond irritating.
Yeah.
I've got all this toot all over my desk and now I need to, well, I can't just throw it away. I need to find a home for this crap they've sent me.
So
don't get too carried away.
Interesting. No, that's interesting.
If they've asked for samples, just send in a box of samples. Plastic free.
Make
it look nice, but don't be weird about it.
No, that's super interesting. There was one, I can't remember who it was, but someone was telling me there was a brand that put a helium balloon inside a box, and the samples were the thing that held the helium balloon down. And I thought it was quite clever, but apparently not. I'll scrape the helium balloon out of the diary. No, joking. Dan Pope from Manulife, he talks about those updates in such a great way because they created something that we've just started doing here, where they create newsletters that they call the Manulife Newsroom, and on that they've got their four headlines for the business in a kind of newsletter journal-esque email that goes out on MailChimp to all their buyers. And it's genius because it's personalised in terms of a name, but it's not, doesn't take loads of time from a brand's perspective, but you've got the founders just had a baby. We've also launched in Waitrose. We're going on to EasyJet. Like all those little bits that like just kind of give it all in one zipped up, nice branded email. And I think that seemed to have worked really well for them. We, just kind of conscious of time, I can't have you on Untold without talking about some of the untold bits. Toughest moment in your career?
I think in terms of sort of at Planet, toughest times, Marigold burning down.
Yeah.
So losing sort of one of our most significant suppliers and a fairly unique one at that.
Yeah.
That was a bad few weeks at work.
Yeah.
Staying open through and dealing with looking after your people through COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we've all been through that, but you know, Planet had 450 employees. So sort of working through that, balancing customer needs with, you know, your team's needs.
Yeah.
Really tough.
Yeah.
I remember when I was very, very early in my career, a slightly challenging staff management issue, someone who was having deeply, deeply inappropriate conversations with customers on the shop floor. That was fun. That was sort of first experience of, right, okay, assistant manager at this little store. We need to have a bit of a talk.
That's amazing. Did you feel a little bit like a dad to talk? Like, I can imagine what the type of conversation was happening, and did it feel a little bit like kind of that potentially that chat that you have when the kids...
Yeah, I mean, now that I've got a 12-year-old daughter, actually, I'd be much better at having that chat.
Amazing, love it.
But you know, when I was 23, it was slightly embarrassing.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, for me, I think there have been some things that Planet have done during my time there that were just really bloody hard to do.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a day.
Yeah.
Some of it took 18 months.
Yeah.
So it's just about persistence and solving all of the endless challenging. So, you know, I did quite a lot of work around packaging.
Yeah.
I mean, anyone that's ever got involved in trying to change packaging knows that that's a bad 18 months at work.
Yeah.
But the day when you crack
it... For own label products, yeah.
Yeah, the day that you crack it is amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, doing stuff that's hard is hard.
It's daily.
Sort of no shit Sherlock.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that I'd love to just unpick a little bit more is Marigold, because it feels incredibly poignant to what's just happened with Tree.
Yeah.
And devastating for the industry.
Yeah.
But what to give, I guess, just to give a bit of colour to listeners who are trying to get in touch with Planet Organic or a Whole Foods or some other farm shop brands and the huge list of people that they used to supply to. Yeah. Talk to us about like the actual impact on the day-to-day workload that has to happen so that someone who is trying to get hold of a Whole Foods now can empathise slightly more with the buyer at Whole Foods or at Planet Organic, because they're going through a pretty turbulent, awful time.
So, I mean, the health food industry is pretty small in terms of the number of wholesalers, number of routes to market. And, you know, Marigold burning down is probably easier to talk about now than, you know, Tree and Health Store going, because there's an awful lot of brands who are still dealing with the fallout of that.
Yeah.
The fallout of that is short-term, mid-term and long-term.
Yeah.
So it's probably the long-term that interests me most in terms of where the industry is going to go, but we're still very much in the dealing with day-to-day.
Of course. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, if on a Saturday you find out that the people that are supposed to be delivering fresh milk to your store on Monday have just burnt down, which means that milk doesn't exist, which means on Monday you're not going to be able to serve any coffees. That was a weekend as well.
Yeah.
You know, so, right, suddenly my first question was, where the hell can I get some milk?
Yeah.
And then, you know, of the 5,000 retail products that Planet stocked, let's say 1,500 of them were from Marigold Health Foods.
Yeah.
Where am I getting all of those from?
Yeah.
And Marigold specifically did a lot of the, you know, really quite unique stuff that no one else touched. You know, they did all the short shelf life chill that no one else was really interested in because there wasn't enough money in it.
Yeah.
You know, brands like San Ambrosia, you know, absolute staple to the industry.
Yeah.
Marigold did all of their logistics. So it was significant.
Yeah.
And I think it was hard. It was, you know, from a personal point of view, it was quite rewarding in some ways, because it's when you really feel the strength of your network and you feel the strength of the relationships that you've built up.
Yeah.
Because when the shit hits the fan and you go to people and you need help and they turn around and help you, you kind of, you know, it's because you've been there, you've been supporting them for however long and you're all in it together, and there was great sort of solidarity. So I think from that point of view, you know, Planet managed to respond fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Because we had, you know, a real sort of solid network to sort of fall back on and to call for help for. But you know, 3 years on, I don't think the industry has recovered from Marigold having burned down. And now sort of Tree going as well, who did a lot of different stuff for a lot of different brands. You know, they weren't just selling out to store, they were consolidating, they were, you know, doing the whole bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, even post Marigold, when brands would come and say, you know, what wholesalers can you recommend? It's like, well, there's like a handful of choices. All with their unique opportunities and challenges. Route to market has just got even harder.
Yeah.
And you've also got, you know, did they have any stock?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if most of the brand stock was at Marigold.
Oh, I mean, there's horror
stories. You can't even get it from anywhere else because there isn't any.
Yeah, yeah.
So they need to go back to their manufacturer and have some made. Well, have they got the cash flow to get any made because they haven't sold that yet?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, and.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrible. It's terrible. I mean,
it's terrible.
There's brands. I mean, small to medium-sized brands that will go under in circumstances like that, right? Because...
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it sort of it's an unforeseen event that you never plan for, but it also I think highlights that you need to have you need to know as much as you can about what's going on within your business.
Yeah.
So, and fundamentally, you need to no matter who you're selling through, you need to be as close as you possibly can to your customer.
Yeah.
Remembering that your customer is not the person that's stocking your product, it's the person that's eating your product.
Yeah.
So if you're selling into a wholesaler or if you're trading on Amazon or you're on some platform, how much data and information have you got about actually where is your product going? Do you know what stores it was in?
Yeah.
Because I think if you're relying on, you know, Tree and suddenly they've gone, just rebuilding that network, well, you don't even know where to start.
Yeah.
They were selling 200 cases a month. Who to? I don't know.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's where there's a. And you'll know, but I won't say it. But there's a wholesaler that I find fantastic to work with because there's a back end where you can see where every single case is going to.
Yeah.
And I think it's such a smart way of operating because it helps us as a brand go, well, this is great. Well, this is working here. Let's push it harder.
Yeah. And so where, you know, if it's going nationwide, well, where do I target local media or why am I not in that particular store in that particular city?
Yeah.
Because a wholesaler is never going to be your sales team.
No.
They're going to wait for someone to place an order and then deliver some boxes.
Agreed. Agreed.
So no.
I think that's the biggest, I think that actually is such a good point because one of the, my key learnings when I was at when I was at Causton Press was my first job at Causton was I went to help them launch. I say to help them launch Australia Uni. I went to sell the cans when they launched cans, and my first day was a rucksack, load of cans on my back, and away we went into London with the sole purpose of my job, putting transfer orders to pull out the other end of wholesale.
Yeah,
and learn from day one that you're like, wow, okay. Being in the wholesaler, you're at the start line. It's not even, the gun hasn't even gone off yet.
No.
You're just in the race. It's then how you pull out stock from the other. I remember going, we launched into Booker. It was amazing. And I think at the time, if you'd have said this to anybody, they'd think you're nuts. But we launched into Booker and then we'd all go down. There was a depot in Brighton. We'd all go down with cash into Booker. We'd buy cases out of Booker and then go sell them in Brighton in the like little bits just to get the sales going. But it's such a key point when you, because I think a lot of challenger brands, sorry, we've kind of like segmented on here, but a lot of challenger brands go, wow, great, we're in five wholesalers. And you're like, okay, well, I mean, let's strategically choose one or two and make them work because to your point, a lot of the, whilst there's a lot less route to market, a lot of them have overlaps in terms of who they supply as well. And actually, going into it, it's like, get the wheels rolling.
Yeah, exactly. And what counts as a sale?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'd follow that a step down the line. You know, I said to any new brand that I've worked with, you know, we do all of this work and we get the product listed and we get it on the website. Until a customer comes back and buys their second one, none of us have done anything.
Agreed. Yeah.
And if that doesn't happen, none of us have done anything.
Yeah.
You've formulated a great product.
Yeah.
You've gone through the branding.
Yeah.
You've done the pain of the packaging. You've figured out your costs and your margins and all the rest of that. You've got it listed at a wholesaler. You've eventually got through to that bloody buyer at Planet Organic. You've eventually listed your product. None of us have done anything yet.
Agree.
Because the actual customer hasn't bought it, eaten it, and gone, I'm going to buy another one then.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And actually, to that point, like where we are now as a business with the new range of crunches, we've managed to unlock some slightly bigger customers. And if anything, that just scares me, because we're now at the point where this range has just launched and you're going, like, we've unlocked the customer, but I'm now placing bigger orders with my manufacturer without knowing whether this is actually going to work or not. So we stockpile to fulfill this customer, but this doesn't work. We're going to be left with a load of stock. Like, it's that, it's exactly to your point.
Yeah. And then what happens when they ask you to take it back because it didn't work?
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Because a wholesaler,
yeah,
a wholesaler won't keep dead stock.
No, agreed. Agreed. Yeah. I mean, hopefully that's not going to happen.
I'm sure it won't happen. It's all going to be fine. Place that order. Go
but
on.
I think it's such an important point, and I love that we've had this conversation, because the whole podcast was set up to talk about the realities of it, and actually, like, yeah, it, like, there's so many, like, if you want to hear the glorified stages of it, there's lots of podcasts that do that, but I love the rawness and the uniqueness of just being able to say, like, it is tough and it is, like, it's fucking worth it, but it takes time, and it, things might not work first time round, and actually the pivot or the evolution or the, it is very rare that you hit a golden bullet from day dot, and yeah, actually that learning curve is super important.
Yeah, and I do think, depending on what route to market you take, the visibility of who your customer is can be easier, it can be hard. Yeah. And if it's hard, actually really keeping in mind your customer is not the wholesaler, your customer is not the retailer. Your customer is the person that's paying retail price for your product, yeah, eating it and enjoying it. And I was listening to one of your previous episodes, you're talking to the Tree Start Coffee,
yeah,
guys, who, you know, they did that sort of, right, we go to events and we sell direct to punter for a long time through the brand.
Yeah.
Which completely puts you in touch with the end user.
Yeah.
But then you reach the stage of having to put in almost what feel like barriers.
Yeah.
Because you're going to go through retail, or you're going to, you know, deal several steps away from your end customer.
Yeah.
And that sort of, the reverse of it can be really hard, where you, yeah, haven't, where you've had that sort of complete contact and then you lose it. So,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah. Who is eating your product?
Yeah, I think a lot of people get, particularly, I think when you, like, we lost sight of that very early doors, and I think it was because I came from the industry, so you automatically go, I know how to get in touch with Planet. I know who supplies Planet. I know who supplies, yeah, Whole Foods. I know the bar at Sainsbury's. I know the bar at Waitrose. You kind of just go plug and play. Whereas actually, if you come in from, I mean, I'm such an advocate for getting industry experience to understand how all those pieces work, but I'm also a massive advocate for people that come in and launch a food brand that have no idea what they're doing, because they're doing it because that product is bloody delicious and their focus is on the customer. I think it's really easy to lose sight of who your customer is.
Yeah.
And actually the trade is a very dangerous place if you do that, because,
yeah,
there's a couple of phone calls and you get stuff listed, but wider than that, it's tough.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's easy to focus on the product.
Yeah, yeah.
The product's the fun bit.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, you can have a great idea for a product, and then you can turn it into a product. You can, yeah, go, I've got this great product.
Yeah.
Without really thinking about, well, who's going to buy it, where and when and how and for,
yeah,
how much.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that just before we sort of start to wrap up, that's another really key point, is looking at retail pricing, what it sits at on shelf, and knowing the margin chain that comes below it, because I think there's probably a lot of founders out there, through no fault of their own, just won't have thought of the price in between. I was talking to a wholesaler the other day, again, won't say who, but they were saying to me that the customer had gone to their end customer, sorry, their supplier had gone to an end customer and given them the price that should have gone to the wholesaler. And then before they know it, they're in trouble, because there's no way this can work unless the supplier makes absolutely no margin, which, yeah, is just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's a, talk just really quickly. It'd be great to hear from your side, kind of health food margin chain, what that might look like. I think there's some real tangibles there for. So let's take when you were at Planet Organic, for example.
So I think if you're a brand looking to get into retail through a wholesaler, what matters is what combined margin do the retailer and the wholesaler make.
Yeah.
The retailer won't want to tell you exactly what they make. They'll be all coy and shy about it. The wholesaler will tell you what they make, but assuming they don't give any discount to the retailer.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you assume that the combined wholesaler-retailer margin is going to be about 55%,
yeah,
you're not far off.
Yeah.
And if you then set your costs up, so, you know, you probably want to be making a 30% margin.
Yeah, at least.
At least.
Yeah.
So in general, you take your cost price and you triple it, and hey presto, there comes your retail price. So if it means that actually you get a deal where you're selling direct to a retailer and they're taking less than that 55, then great. But also a lot of those retailers are then going to have an expectation of a 10% marketing reinvestment. Is that marketing or is that margin? Well, it's bloody difference. It's still cash. But no, I totally agree. I think having... There's sort of two sides to that. Firstly is, you know, setting up cost structure well from the outset.
Yeah.
How the hell you do that now with the cost of everything going up and up and up? I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
But also then having a very dispassionate view as to, well, if this is my cost price, is my product viable?
Yeah.
Because the retail price cannot be an accident.
No.
It can't just be, that's what it needs to be.
No.
Because if that doesn't fit that occasion, it's not a viable product.
Yeah, yeah.
So it needs to be changed somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
Different size,
yeah.
Different recipe,
I agree.
Different something.
Yeah.
Or a different commercial strategy.
Yeah.
You know, maybe actually you're going to focus on D2C.
Yeah, yeah. And it's working backwards, isn't it? It's finding where this is going to sit on shelf at a realistic price and then going, well, how do we get this to that price?
Yeah.
With that 50%. Like, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because you also go, all of the support that comes with it that brands have to do in a specialty or a health food store, the samplings and the promotional discounts
and the 25% discount and
the
marketing sponsorship.
There's a lot, but I think you also get to a point where, I mean, we've always taken the view where you go, as long as this isn't like a hugely loss-making exercise, your first couple of customers have to with all the, if you're putting people into sample and you're putting like, and it's not your out of work brother-in-law, it's like your team or people who you're going to pay to go in and help do it, you kind of almost have to take that leap of faith and go, right, the first few months in Planet Organic, we know that we're not going to make any money here because I want to have a 25% off launch strategy, and that is probably going to be a gondola end that might be a lot of free pipe fill as well. Like, so it's, but then you're going to have a lot of customers that, well, a lot of the time will come back and just keep repeat purchasing and sort of pushing it forward. So there's it's a really sort of interesting.
Yeah, and the buyer has that same opinion.
Yeah.
You know, it takes time to, you know, arrange the listing, get the product in. So any listing that you get from a buyer is an investment from the buyer and their time and the company and their money.
Yeah.
In which case, they're kind of looking at a launch plan as we need to build this up quickly so that it pays us back
for
the effort that we've put into it.
100%. Because I guess the whole margin conversation with customers as well, it's like, it's kind of, bear with me, it's kind of irrelevant until the product starts selling well anyway. So you're kind of like, there's a lot of people that can go back and forth on squeezing for an extra 2% here or there, and you're like, actually it's probably better to give the extra promotion because it's going to sell well, and in the future you're going to be making more money because, or both parties are going to make more money because it's selling more. So actually losing a little bit earlier on is better for the long-term sort of longevity of the product.
Yeah, yeah. As long as, you know, if you've always supported the retailer with a third off and then you turn around and go, well, we can only do 25 now.
Yeah.
That's a bit tricky.
Yeah, yeah.
Hang on. What happened to the third?
Yeah. It's, amazing. Amazing. Well, look, as we start to wrap up, I would love to hear how brands can get in touch with you, how they can hear more about Wonderland Ventures, how So how that piece fits in for our listeners, and if there's an opportunity for them to maybe email you or reach out on LinkedIn?
Yeah, sure. So they can easily find me on LinkedIn. I've always been very open with my email address, even when I was at Planet, because I'm very happy not to reply to emails.
Yeah.
Or I was when I was a buyer. So you can email me at al.overton@wonderlandventures.co.uk. And yeah, you know, if you think I can help, we can help, then reach out.
Great.
Always happy to talk.
Fantastic. Well, Al, thank you so much for coming on Told. I really, really appreciate it. And we'll catch up soon.
Oh, it's been fun. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Thank you so much for listening to Untold. As always, we are so grateful that you give us a little bit of your time.
We really, really are. And as ever, please do give us some feedback. We love it. So any reviews, please subscribe, obviously, as well. It helps us with the old ratings position in the podcast, wherever you download them. But yeah, please do let us know what you thought of the episode. We'd love to hear what you guys think.
And as always, this episode is brought to you by The Savourists. We make lip-smackingly delicious savoury snacks that can be found at www.thesavourist.com or the.savourist on Instagram and TikTok. Ciao for now. See you next time.